Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Slate's parenting podcast for Thursday, March 8th, the Minimalist Hellscape Edition. I'm Gabriel Roth, an editor at Slate and the father of Eliza, age 7, and Leo, who is 3.5.
I'm Rebecca Lavoie. I'm a journalist and podcaster in New Hampshire, and I am mom to Henry, who is 16, my stepdaughter Lily, who is 17, and my son Teddy, who is 15.
And I'm Carvo Wallace, a writer and podcaster in Oakland, California, and I am the father to Georgia, who is 12, and Ezra, who is, as of this Saturday, 15 years old.
Happy birthday, Ezra. Today on our show, we'll be talking to psychotherapist Lynn Lyons about anxiety in kids, in parents, everywhere. Plus, as always, we'll have questions from listeners, we'll have triumphs and fails, we'll make recommendations, and on Slate Plus, Slate's Greg Lavallee has an outstanding instance of parental failure and child guilt tripping. First up, we got a lot of response to last week's episode, especially the segment on chickenpox sharing. That episode is being discussed in the Slate Parenting Facebook group, facebook.com/groups/slateparenting. Thanks for your emails. Thanks for your voicemails. We love getting your questions that way. But if you want to join the discussion, that's happening in the Facebook group. Just go to Facebook and search for Slate Parenting. Now, let's talk about triumphs and fails. Rebecca, we missed you last week. Triumph or fail?
Oh, thanks. Well, my triumph is that I took, Kevin and I took our two kids that were available, Teddy and Lily, on our vacation last week. We had a wonderful, wonderful family vacation. A lot of hanging out on the beach, a lot of snorkeling, a lot of sitting in beach shacks, people watching. It was really wonderful. But I think that my favorite moment of the entire trip was when a really nice fellow vacationer who was a complete stranger came over to our little chairs as we were sitting on a beach and said to me, "Your teenage son is so affectionate toward you. What is your secret?" Mm. And I was like, oh my God, it was so nice. Because Teddy does, he's an affectionate kid anyway. Both my boys are very affectionate. We are very like kiss on the mouth, huggy kind of affectionate family. And on vacation especially, he just mellows out so much and just turns into his funniest and best and most relaxed self and will grab my hand if we're walking somewhere or throw his hand over my arm over my shoulder if we're walking somewhere or be sure to sit next to me if we're in a restaurant. And it's just like so sweet and something I'm like a little bit used to at this point. But it just felt really good to, you know, have that conversation with somebody because it made me realize that, you know, not every kid is super affectionate. Not every family encourages a lot of physical and outward affection. And as this woman pointed out, especially with boys, it's just not something you see all the time. And I'll just say, it's really, really nice to have teenage sons who still have to kiss their mom. And as Teddy says, if you don't want to kiss your mom, that's on you. as I always point out, it could also be on your mom if your mom sucks. But whatever. But yeah, it was just a really, really nice moment. And my favorite moment of the whole vacation that was packed full of them.
That's so great. I often worry, you know, that as the kids get older, they're not going to be holding my hands as we walk down the street, or they're not going to be like climbing onto me for a hug at home or whatever. And I wonder if you have any tips on how I can maintain the physical affection that is, for me, one of the best parts of parenthood.
Yeah, I just say normalize it. You know, I think that like I did not grow up in a particularly affectionate household. There was not a lot of hugging, kissing, any of that stuff growing up. But all the families that I liked hanging out with, you know, there was just a lot of just very loose, comfortable feelings around, you know, touching and hugging. And that's just kind of what I always wanted in my own family. So if you're doing it all the time and you don't stop, there's very little reason why it should stop as far as I'm concerned. You know, I don't know. I mean, that's been my secret is just to just keep it normal. Don't make it weird. I don't like force the kids to kiss me goodnight before they go to bed. But, you know, I think maybe the not forcing helps too. I don't know. It's not precise, but it's worked for me.
I remember when I was a little kid, my dad used to, when he would drop me off at school, my dad was a cab driver. And so he would drop me off at school in a cab, which was like, I had mixed feelings about as an elementary schooler. But he would always kiss me and my half brother on the cheek. And he had this big bushy beard, you know, like this 80s beard. And it was always he was always like super moisturized. He put like all this like lotion on his face and this like beard. And he would always lean over and kiss us before we got out of the car. And we both hated it and loved it. Like we loved hating it was so much fun. But now we have the exact same thing. Ezra does not, he gets really annoyed, or like playfully really annoyed whenever we hug him, or like, but then we just do it anyway, and he's like, "Ah, this is terrible," but then he like lets it happen for a long time.
Nice. I also get like Leo is often afraid that I'm gonna scratch him with my beard, and when I went away on a trip and I promised that I would come back and kiss him, and when I came back after he was asleep, I promised I would come into their room and give them a kiss when I came back. And then while I was gone, he said to his mom, "When Daddy comes back and gives me a kiss, is he going to scratch me on the face?"
Aww.
And aww. So now I have learned that there is fear attached to the father's kiss as well. What a minefield. Carvel, did you have a triumph or a fail?
We had a triumph this week, and I'll get to a fail soon, I promise you guys. I mean, but we just had such a good weekend that it's hard not to talk about it. So, I mean, Saturday was Ezra's birthday, which was actually, whatever. He didn't know what he wanted to do, and then he kept having all these plans, but they kept changing, and he was going to hang out with friends, then he wasn't. Then, you know, it was like teenage drama stuff, and then but we knew that we were going to have a family meal together, so he wanted to have a brunch, and of all the places that we wanted to go, all the really good places in Oakland that we were hoping he would go, he decided on IHOP, which was like, oh, really? And so we went to IHOP, and it was fine, and everyone was kind of annoyed with everyone during the whole time, and Georgia was being a little weird because she always gets weird on her brother's birthday, and it was fine. So then the next day, Saturday or Sunday came along, and I decided that we were going to go see Lady Bird because I had seen it, and Ezra's really into film, and he really liked Boyhood, and I thought that, you know, it's a similar storytelling style, and I thought that Georgia would enjoy it or appreciate it. And so I made this plan for us to go, and then Georgia was like, got really mad. She's like, "I don't want to do that. I don't want to go hang out and see a movie with you guys." Like, ah. She was like really annoyed by it, and it was about to be a whole thing. And eventually, like, Ezra and I just decided we were going to leave without her, and then at the last minute, she came running down and joined us. And then we saw the movie, and they really loved the movie, like really loved it, and had so many questions about it afterwards, and talked so much about teenagers and parents and how parents are. And then we went for a walk afterwards, which is what I had planned, in this cemetery. It sounds grim, but there's this cemetery in Oakland that's like a park called Mountain View Cemetery. And the theater we saw it is like a few blocks from Mountain View. So after the movie, we just started walking towards the cemetery. And we walked for, I don't know, maybe an hour and a half or 2 hours along this huge cemetery that goes way up the hill. And there's all these fountains. And we just like had the best conversations and the best time. It was going back. And, you know, whenever we go there, the first thing we do is find the gravestone that has our last name on it. It's like this weird morbid thing that we do. And we, you know, we found that one. And then we just, it was like hard to describe, but we were there, and then the sun was setting, and it was like this beautiful silhouettes. And we just talked. We just talked about everything, about the movie, about life, about parenting, about the history, because there's a whole Civil War section of the cemetery. And we talked about that. And, you know, it just was a great day with the kids. And it was like, the kind of thing that I'm always trying to organize these like free emotionally and intellectually exciting trips, and the kids always resist it, and they always say, "I don't want to do it," and we always joke that that's part of it. They have to complain the whole time and then really enjoy it. And but whenever that happens, I love that. And this one on Sunday was a full success. So that was it.
That's awesome.
Good job turning it around too. Good job.
Yeah.
Okay, I am afraid I also had a triumph this week. It's a three triumphs week, but
the worst.
Over the weekend, on Saturday, We just had one of those overscheduled days. Like we had, there's two different families who we had been trying to make plans with forever, and somebody keeps getting sick and you keep canceling it. And so we landed on like one family came over for brunch and we had a nice brunch with them. And then another family came over for dinner and we had a nice dinner with them. And these are lovely people. We love to see them. We love having them over. And at the same time, like if doing that much, like socializing all in a row, it wears me out. Like I, by the end of like halfway through the second family visit, I am like starting to fade. The thing that I hadn't seen before is that this time it hit Leo really hard. Like usually the kids get super excited and they're playing with other kids and they're running around and they're screaming. And by the end, they'll be like wild and manic and then we'll have to like get them into bed. By the time it got to be like almost bedtime and he was having a public meltdown. And he was getting into fights over who gets to play with his toys and like didn't want to eat this or drink that. All of the stuff that like he's mostly grown out of, but he was doing some like serious regressing. And I fortunately, because I was myself getting a little tired of being with other humans, I could recognize exactly what was happening to him. And I just like scooped him up and took him downstairs to his room. And I was like, yep, we've seen a lot of people. And now we're just going to be quiet for a while. We're just going to sit here. And if you want, we can read a book. But we're just going to be sort of quiet and chill. And he just kind of sat there on my lap for like 5 minutes. And so he was sort of crying about whatever had been the last outrage. But he just kind of wound himself down. And I was like, okay, now we're going to get into your PJs and then we can go upstairs and like see your friend for a little bit longer and then we're going to get ready for bed. But like what you need right now is to be on your own or just in a quiet room and just sort of wind yourself down. And he just like snapped right into it immediately. And he became that sort of lovely, clingy, baby-like way that toddlers get when they're like tired and sort of sweet. And it went from being like now he's being a terror and terrorizing our friends and his friend. And it turned into like now he's being a lovely clingy koala. And that was one of those. I like those parts of parenting where like you can just unwind a kid in a very easy way. That was my parenting triumph.
Your parenting triumph is that you basically were able to on one occasion execute the power of suggestion.
Is that what it was?
That's basically what it was. Like you one time you told your kid to do something and then they did it. I mean,
yes,
that's a triumph.
And it took what it took was like tremendous empathy to pull that off even that one time.
Yeah, no, that is a triumph. I remember when Ezra was a baby, a super baby, and he would be, you know, just like I could hold him in my forearm and he'd be trying to fall asleep, you know, and I could see the point at which he was like close to falling asleep, but still resisting. Like he had already done that little sigh and he was like, it was just a matter of time. And I would do this thing where I would like slowly sweep my hand in front of his eyes from the top to the bottom, like from his forehead down in front of his eyes over his face. Like I was doing a Jedi mind trick. And then the part when my hand was over his eyes, he would close his eyes because he couldn't see anything. And then when I'd remove my hand, voila, he'd be asleep.
Ooh.
And it was like the most amazing trick. And I would do it for everyone. I'd wait, you know, I'd be like, you guys got to see me put my kid to sleep with just the power of my Jedi hands. It's amazing.
Wow.
And unfortunately, that was the extent of my psychic powers with my son. But it was good while it lasted.
And then like the fourth time you try to show somebody, then, oh, it turns out he's outgrown that. Like this past he just grew out of that and you don't have that anymore.
Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now, getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So, just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average, 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Before we move on, let's do the business. As always, if you have a question that you would like us to answer on the air, you can leave us a message at 424-255-7833 or send us an email at momanddad@slate.com. Here's another reminder that we are moving our Facebook presence. The new address is facebook.com/groups/slateparenting, or just search for Slate Parenting on Facebook. It's already a very lively community. It's even more active than our old Mom and Dad Are Fighting page. Check it out, join the group, and join the conversation. I want to let you know about another great Slate podcast, Represent, a space for discussion highlighting movies, TV, and online shows created by and or about women, people of color, and those in the LGBTQ community. Join the host Aisha Harris as she dives deep into conversations with critics about the latest pop cultural news and filmmakers about what they do and how they do it. You should check out recent episodes about the Oscars ceremony and upcoming this week, How Does the Media See the City of Chicago?, looking at the Showtime series The Chi. That's Represent, wherever you get your podcasts. On Slate Plus today, we've got Slate Director of Technology Greg Lavallee sharing an astonishing parenting fail. If you want to hear that segment and others like it, you can join Slate Plus at slate.com/momanddadplus. It's just $35 for your first year. It helps us make this show. It helps support Slate and all of our other great podcasts. And of course, in return, you get extended ad-free versions of this show and your other favorite Slate podcasts every week. If you want to support Mom and Dad Are Fighting, go to slate.com/momanddadplus and join Slate Plus today. Okay, back to the show. So something we've talked about on the show quite a lot, especially in the past month or two, has been anxiety in kids. It's a topic that I think a lot of parents are facing right now. There was a big article last October in the New York Times Magazine called The Kids Who Can't by Benoit Denzit-Lewis that focused a lot on kids who suffer from really extreme anxiety and the lengths that parents are going to try to help them. And so today we're going to be talking to Lynn Lyons. She's a psychotherapist who works with children and families about anxiety and the author of books including Anxious Kids, Anxious Parents. Lynn Lyons, thanks so much for being with us. Am I right that we're seeing more kids with very severe anxiety nowadays? And if so, why is that?
Yeah, you're probably right. We are seeing more kids with anxiety. I think the interesting thing is whether or not there are more kids with more severe anxiety, because I think what's really getting everybody's attention is this pervasive idea that kids are anxious and worried and they can't cope and they can't function. Interestingly, the information on the rates of depression in kids and teenagers is really, really exact. The World Health Organization tracks it like crazy. But when you look for the statistics on anxiety in kids, it's really hard to find those numbers. But the pervasive sense is that, yeah, kids are more anxious and really parents are more anxious. So when people ask me, well, why are kids so much more anxious than they used to be? Why are they so much more worried? I usually say, well, you know, the parents are kind of nuts these days. We're uptight as a generation, this group of parents that are raising these kids. We've got, you know, post 9/11 stuff going on, terrorism, the world is a dangerous place. Social media, technology is not helping kids nor their parents in dealing with sort of the information and all of the stuff going on in the world. So it's just a pretty overwhelming place.
And what do you do when a kid comes to see you with very severe anxiety that's preventing them from doing what they need to do? What kinds of things do you do for those kids?
So the first thing is that I don't see kids alone. And it doesn't make any sense to me, actually, why you would work with a really severely anxious kid and not be working with a family at the same time. We know that there's a generational pattern in this. We know that it's a systems thing. It's sort of, I see anxiety as a cult leader that sort of moves into families and kind of takes over. And parents need a lot of support in terms of being able to interrupt the patterns that are sort of sustaining the anxiety. So what I'm first going to do when I meet with a family is I do a lot of education, a lot of information about how anxiety works. It's a really consistent pattern. Once you understand it, it's not very complicated, actually. It does the same thing over and over and over again.
Tell us about that pattern.
So basically, if you look at what the demands of anxiety are, very simply, it wants certainty and comfort. So it wants to know everything that's going to happen. It demands predictability, and it wants to feel comfortable. So it doesn't matter so much what you're anxious about. And that's where a lot of people get tripped up in what we call the content of the anxiety. What matters is that when worry shows up, when anxiety shows up, you have to understand how it operates, and then you have to have a response to it that actually interrupts the pattern of that certainty seeking and that comfort seeking. So parents and teachers, and I work a lot with schools, and so the adults in the world of an anxious child need to understand that there are a lot of things that we do that feel so caring and so supportive and so warm and so helpful that are actually making the problem worse by saying to kids, look, we will make sure that everything goes as planned. We'll make sure that you're very comfortable. We'll make sure that nothing triggers your worry. And when you're playing into that cult leader's demands, the problem gets worse. So immediately when I'm meeting a family for the first time, they're going to get a big dose of understanding how this thing operates.
So I guess my question is, I want to know how does a parent or caretaker know the difference between childhood anxiety and normal childhood fear? And I'm asking this because our daughter experienced a lot of many years of, you know, fear of monsters and fear of going down the hallway and anxiety about shooters. And just, you know, she talked about these things and I couldn't tell the extent to which they interfered with her ability to operate. And my own childhood had a lot of that. And so part of me is like, well, that's normal. You're a kid. You're scared. It's a scary world. That's what you feel. So I guess how do parents know the difference between something that is like anxiety that needs to be dealt with by a medical professional or normal just kind of childhood fears and worries? Or is that difference? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's on a spectrum, of course. And so you sort of alluded to it a little bit. It's how much it's interfering with the functioning of the child. So if it's getting in the way of normal developmental processes, so if you've got a kid who's not capable of sleeping in their own room by themselves, and if you've got a kid who's got a real difficulty being away from the parents, so gosh, the only babysitter we're allowed to have is grandma because nobody else can stay with Jacob because he freaks out. If they're having a lot of difficulty going to school, staying in school, younger kids tend to have a lot of what we call somatic symptoms. So when you start seeing things like chronic tummy aches and headaches and what we call vague somatic complaints, so saying, you know, I don't feel good. Anytime that you begin to see a child sort of restricting their environment, so their world is getting smaller, making a lot of demands on the adults that things need to be a certain way. So the way that I sort of frame it up for parents is, if you feel like your child's fears or worries or anxieties, whatever term you want to use, if you feel like those are running your house, if you feel like we have to sort of check in with the anxiety and make sure that everything's okay with him first before we move forward, that's when you have a problem. Now, whether or not you need to address that with professional help really depends on how capable you are as a parent of dealing with it, because there are a lot of self-help stuff out there. There's a lot of great videos. The book that Reed Wilson and I wrote was really aimed to help parents get a handle on it. And we really feel like, and I really feel like, parents can do a lot on their own once they recognize the patterns and once they step in. But if you've got a kid who's not going to school, not sleeping in their own bed, you're taking them to the doctor all the time because they think there's something wrong with their tummy or migraine headaches, all those kinds of things are big red flags.
One of the things that, you know, full disclosure, you and I, when my kids were younger, we worked together a little bit on with my family stuff. And one of the things that I took away from talking to you, and I don't know if this is what you meant or not, but reading some of your blog posts, I just wonder, like, transparency between parents and kids when kids say, I don't know what's going to happen, so I don't want to go. And as a parent, you say, you know, I think what you said before was like, oh, I can see why you'd be scared of that. Maybe we shouldn't go. But instead you say, yeah, I don't know what's going to happen either.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah. And that's the whole normalizing thing.
Yeah.
I talk to parents all the time about let's roll around in the mites and maybes of life. So it's we're not going to completely get rid of routines and schedules and predictability. And sometimes teachers will say that. I'll say, look, you know, we have to allow things to be uncertain, allow things to just sort of happen. And teachers or parents will say, oh, so we're going to just completely dispense with schedules, right? We're just going to live in chaos. No. it's the over planning and the over scheduling and the over preparing. So you give the information, but I always say I couldn't do my job if somebody said, Lynn, you can't use the phrase of course anymore.
Right.
Because I say, of course you're going to be anxious. You know, I'm taking my son to get his driver's license and, you know, of course we're both nervous and our hearts are pounding. And of course you don't know what people are thinking of you. And of course you don't know, you know, how your future is going to unfold. So it's really about, you know, so I did mean that. And you're exactly right, Rebecca. It's about saying, yeah, I don't know either. And like, I hope it goes well, but, you know, you never know. You know, I'm terrified I'm going to throw up. Yeah, you could. And boy, that'll really suck if that happens, but we'll deal with it. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, but to that point, this is a question that I think we get a lot from parents. And I think this came up even in the last week's show, which is like, this question of like, there are bad things and right now, especially in our kids, through whatever means, whether that's accidental overexposure on the part of parents or just being in the world or hearing stuff from other kids, there are a lot of legitimate things to be afraid of. And when kids, especially little kids, come to us with the fear, mommy, I'm afraid someone's going to break in the house tonight and shoot me, right? I mean, what do you say to your kid who's 6 years old and has that fear? Because part of you wants to be like, honey, no one's going to break in the house and shoot us, but you can't 100% guarantee that. So I think a lot of parents question how to parse out that level of honesty and transparency.
Right. So it depends on the age of the child, of course. But this is where it really helps if you stay out of the content. So we want to give reassurance, right? We want to say, oh, no, it'll be fine. Oh, no, you won't throw up. Oh, no, there's no spiders. Oh, spiders don't hurt you. Oh, nobody's going to break into our house. But you get caught then in this trap of just providing certainty all the time. And what if it's things that you can't provide certainty about? So I'm terrified I'm going to throw up. Oh, no, you won't throw up. Well, how do you know? I'm terrified somebody I love is going to die. Oh, no, nobody's going to die. Well, yeah, I just heard that, you know, my friend's dad died. So we can't get caught in that trap. This is why when we're talking process instead of content, and this is a hard thing for parents to understand, and it's sort of the nail that I bang all the time with my hammer, is that when a kid says, I'm terrified, fill in the blank, you can say, oh, there's your worry showing up. You know, and I can understand why you would be afraid of that. And that's where your imagination takes you. And so we want to provide safety and security and secure attachment for our kids and all of that stuff that makes them feel like they can step out into the world. But we also want them to recognize that the hard part about being a human being is that we know that the future is uncertain and we don't like that and we have to live with that. So one thing, just so you know, it's never been a safer time to be a kid in the United States of America. Statistically, like we have these big bad things that happen, but just sort of the basic sort of disease, accident, stranger kidnapping, all of that stuff we're doing really well on. But of course, there's the big news stories that make us feel so frightened as parents and as kids. But to be able to say, of course you're going to feel worried about that because you heard that on the news. Of course, you know, of course you're going to have that thought. But say you've got a kid who's lying in bed, you know, they're 8 years old, and they say, mommy, I'm afraid if I go to sleep that somebody's going to come into the house and steal me. Well, you can reassure them and say, no, that won't happen. And you can say, well, look, we just installed a $50,000 alarm system, so they're not going to come in. I had had one family that did do that, and it didn't work, by the way. But what you really want to say is, oh, my gosh, your imagination, that's how worry works, right? Worry shows up. So I have kids name their worry. You know, we're going to name it Gladys. We're going to name it Fred. We're going to name it Pete. And, gosh, Gladys predictably shows up at bedtime, grabs onto your imagination, and has you start to worry about all these possible things that could happen. So rather than addressing the specific fear, which is what we want to do, it's so much helpful to be able to address the process of worry, grabbing onto uncertainty, going in there with our imagination, being catastrophic in what we imagine, and teaching kids how to deal with that.
How much of this, too, is about parents getting trapped with the whole, I just want my kid to be like a normal kid and not have to only wear this one specific kind of pants and only, you know, be able to eat this one specific kind of food and have to have this specific comfort item. And I see all these other kids out there and they're able to do it. And that's like a trap too, right?
Yeah. So parenting right now is weird. Like parents, we talk a good game and we talk about like letting kids be who they are and we're going to just allow them to sort of evolve and this kind of stuff. But what I see over and over again is parents really get freaked out when their kid is a little bit different or does things in a different way or doesn't fit into the mold. And I'll tell you, never in the history of me being a therapist for 29 years has a parent come in and said, you know what, I really think the problem is we put too much pressure on our kid. They never say that. They always say, we don't know where it comes from. You know, we just want him to do his best and how whatever makes him happy. They never come in and say, oh, God, you know, like we're really sort of rigid about the way things are. They never say that. I get them there, right? I'm like, okay, look, I hate to break it to you. But it really is a lot of what we transmit to kids, both about our own stress and about the way we want things to go. And we're good at disguising it. Like, we just want him to be happy, or we just want him to fit in, or we just – and they pick up on that pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So what about – what can parents do when they are worried by something, let's say, in their lives or something in politics or in the world, or when that worry is actually – they can feel that radiating from themselves and potentially making their kids anxious too? And I'm not thinking of anyone specific, but let's say hypothetically there were a dad
– asking for a friend.
Who worried a lot about, let's say, global warming or the state of the planet or whatever. And his general anxiety, he felt, wasn't always healthy for his family or for his kids. What could that hypothetical dad do?
Well, that hypothetical dad, it's good because it sounds like this hypothetical dad probably has some, like, insight into his own behavior. So that's a really good start. Anxiety is contagious. Stress is contagious. So kids are watching us all the time. So one of the great things you can do is you can talk to your kids about the things that make you worried within reason. You know, don't come home and go like, oh, my gosh, I just lost my job and I think we're going to lose the house. But you want to model for kids how we handle the uncertainty of life. So one thing you pay attention to, and I talk to parents about this a lot, is what I call safety chatter. So this constant sort of running dialogue about sort of the world or what's going on, or be careful, or okay, watch out, or you know, I need you to pay attention, and you know, the world is saying the world is a terrible place. Catastrophic parents are really good at giving safety information and then providing often the audio and the video about what will happen if you don't, you know, heed my warnings. And that's what freaks kids out. So being able to really pay attention to the language that you're using and modeling how you handle what we might refer to as sort of run-of-the-mill problems. Kids who are raised by anxious parents, there are three things we know about them from the research. One is that they are lousy at tolerating uncertainty, not surprisingly. They're not very good independent problem solvers. And they don't score very well on the autonomy scale. So if you know that you're a worried person, if you know that you tend to get worked up about things, you got to make a really conscious effort to teach your kids those three things. You want to model problem solving. You want to put your own worry aside, and you want to support their autonomy. the homework assignment that I give to parents all the time is that I want you to take an inventory of three things that you're doing for your kids that your kids can probably do for themselves, and I want you to stop doing them. So don't worry so much about the big issues, you know, like the global warming and that kind of stuff. Model the day-to-day problem solving. Model the what do we do when we get a flat tire? What do we do when our flight is canceled? What do we do when, you know, we can't find the car keys and we're supposed to be somewhere on time? The more you freak out, the more they freak out. It's so, so contagious. So being able, you know, like Rebecca was saying, that transparency, saying, oh, my gosh, you know what? I am stressing out a little bit right now because I can't find the car keys. But let's think about what we're going to do. Walk through it. Verbalize. Show kids how to problem solve. It's enormously helpful.
That's great. And I'm sure our hypothetical dad, if he's listening, will do his best to put that into action.
I'm sure he will. He's a good listener, I heard.
All right. Lynn Lyons, thank you so much for being with us. This was really helpful.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes. So doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Carvel, we have a follow-up question for you. You gave an answer a couple weeks ago to a question about summer camp, and somebody emailed us with a follow-up question. Let's play that now.
Hi, guys. This message is mostly for Carvel. You sing the praises of sleepaway camp for your kids. You have camp recommendations to send kids of color. Was this a concern of yours when sending your kids to camp? I'm the father of two boys of color. We live in Portland, and they attend a school that is predominantly white, live in a city that is predominantly white, and have little interaction with people of color except for a few friends and family members. My fear is sending them to a camp where they are the other, treated unfairly, or seen as different than other black kids. Any advice and recommendations would be greatly appreciated. Thanks for the great show.
Yes, I think that that is an issue. And I think that that's an issue whether or not it actually happens in a discernible way that the kid is treated differently or experiences being treated like another. I think it happens just – it's just hard. It's just hard to be the only black kid around all white kids. I mean, it doesn't matter what people do. It's just hard. And so because – and I think it's part of it's because people do things that are difficult without knowing it because everything is so baseline. It's just baseline – you're just – baseline is white. That's normal. And so you just – at your very core, feel like something is wrong with you. You don't fit in. And then people say things. They don't mean to say things, but they say things. Or they say things they think are just funny and interesting but turn out to, like, stick in your mind. So it's a rough experience. And so I think for any black kid growing up in Portland, which is a rapidly gentrifying city, I mean, Oregon has this crazy white supremacy history anyway, the whole state. And Portland did have a thriving black community for a while in the 70s and 80s. But, of course, gentrification has changed that significantly. So now – if you're a black person living in Portland, you're kind of on an island. And I can imagine that's a difficult experience for your boys in their daily life. So I too would agree that you don't want to, if there's any way you can avoid it, you don't want to replicate that in their summer camp. You want to give them a different experience. Now, what's missing from this letter are two key factors. One is the ages of these kids, because that has a factor. And then the other one is, like, what are your financial means/appetite for sending them somewhere that's farther away. Because without knowing those two, it's hard to make a recommendation. The kids that I, the camp that I send our, that we send our kids to is Oakland Feather River Camp, which is not too far. I mean, it's in Northern California in the Sierras. It is historically an incredibly diverse camp because Oakland is an incredibly diverse city, and it is the official camp of the city of Oakland. And so kids do come there from far away. I think they told me once there was a kid there from like Texas or something, might have been the farthest. So I know kids do go there. That's Oakland Feather River Camp. You want to look into that. I know actually the camp executive director was a black man. I don't know if he still is or not, or who's the ED now. But so actually there is a website called multiculturalcompassion.blogspot.com, which is looks exactly like it sounds, but it does have a multicultural camp list. Oakland Feather River is actually on that list. The one that is kind of the most renowned in the country is called Camp Atwater. It's an 89-year-old camp that serves kids 8 to 14, all African-American. Unfortunately, that's in North Brookfield, Massachusetts, so that's going to be quite a hike. And there are a number of camps in the Midwest, some in Illinois, et cetera. The closest one to where you are geographically is ours, is Oakland Feather River. And that's not a camp that's black. It's just a camp that's extremely diverse. And probably, my guess would be, probably more diverse than anything you're going to find in Portland or Oregon or Washington, or even a lot of Northern California. So I wish I could give you specific recommendations. It is a hard thing to find. I think it is an important thing to find. I think if you can in any way, if you come across anything in your Google search that looks like this can work, I would highly recommend. I would listen to that impulse to see what you can do to make sure that your kids aren't the only ones, only black kids in their entire camp experience.
Carvel, can you say a bit more about what is it like for a kid to be the only black kid around or at a camp or in a particular environment?
Well, I mean, kids already like feel weird, you know, so it's like it's just like another really big, complicated thing to feel weird about. My experience of it is that like I said, like, I mean, I had maybe 4 years of my life from fifth grade through eighth grade, 3 years, I guess that is, in which I was really seemed like the only black kid like anywhere. And it was just it was like ridiculously alienating. I mean, some people were actively racist. Some people were mildly racist. I mean, everyone was like had some slight racial prejudice that would just come out in the way that they talked about stuff, or just like weird little things like someone turning to you anytime any discussion of anything black related came up, like someone would be talking about basketball and then they'd be like, what? They'd turn to me and then everyone would just stop and look at me like I was going to have some like extra insight on Michael Jordan that other people didn't have or something. And it's just these things that constantly make you feel different. And I think that also people over time internalize that feeling of difference. I mean, the reality is if you're a black person and you're around all white people all the time, then you are going to inherit a basic belief that white is better than black, because that is the basic belief that our country operates on. It just really is. And as black people, you have to resist that. You have to work against that. And one of the ways that you work against that is by like being in community with other black folks and building that identity and supporting each other. And that's kind of what we do. And so when you don't have that, that's really hard. You know, that's really hard. So I just think it's just like it's just this constant experience of feeling like you're less than, but for reasons that have nothing to do with you, but that, you know, you have to live with and you're trying to sort of like apologize for and make up for. And because you just want to be a social person, like you just like any kid just wants to be social. You want to have friends, you have crushes on people, you want to like blah, 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 you know, you just want to fit in. And so when it feels like your blackness is the thing that keeps you from fitting fully in, then you start to like resent being black, which is a terrible, terrible long-term experience to have. And that is what happens to a lot, not every, but a lot of black kids who grow up in like overwhelmingly white environments.
Yeah.
Thanks. That was a very enlightening answer. Let's take another question. This one is from a listener named Sally Dixon.
Dear Carvel, Rebecca, and Gabe. Hi guys, my name is Sally and I have a question about older kids and their stuff. We live in Germany and on our corner is a giveaway box where people leave unwanted items in good repair for others to pick up. My 6-year-old daughter is crazy about this box and wants to clear it out daily. She brings home the occasional score, recently some Moomin's Kitsch we all love, but Also many random items. Yesterday it was 3 placemats and a draft stopper. We have no use for either of these items. We moved here from Australia 2 years ago with just 6 suitcases, and I really enjoyed the opportunity to press reset on all the stuff my husband and I accumulated over the years. We're not living some minimalist hellscape, but we're trying to minimize the crap. So the desire of my daughters to hoard the neighborhood's unwanted goods has been an unwelcome development. It's one we can deal with in the short term by setting limits on what she can pick up, and she's fine with that. But it's also got me thinking about how we should deal with our kids' stuff as they get older and will want to exert more control over this, especially once they have pocket money to spend on their own things. So my question is, how have you put limits on how much stuff your older kids can own? It'd be nice to start doing the groundwork now if possible. Big fan of the podcast. Can't wait to hear your thoughts. Best wishes, Sally Dixon.
I love this question. And first of all, how lucky are you that you live in a neighborhood right now that has this incredibly cool community thing, right? You put something that's in good repair in a box and someone can just take it. I don't blame your kids at all for shopping at that store every single day. It's like a treasure hunt. It's an exciting opportunity to get something that is different, that is new, you know, completely for free. And you just have to understand, I think, that like culturally for a lot of kids, that would be just a big shift and a cool one. And so that's probably what's driving a lot of the bringing home of stuff that you don't want nor need. So I wouldn't sweat it. I mean, the one thing I would say about that particular box is that maybe you could encourage your kids to also contribute to the box, put stuff in it as well. You know, if they find something there they really value and love, maybe they'd be willing to give up the, you know, dish drainer or whatever it is you didn't need. As far as older kids, when they have their own money and start accumulating their own stuff, this is the thing, and this is my opinion. When you license your kids, when you give them the agency of some independence that involves them having and managing their own money and buying their own things, my opinion is it is their money and they can buy their own things. And if they are wanting to have a life surrounded by, in my younger son's case, a bunch of really dumb like video game knickknacks, like 3D printed characters, you know, stickers, patches that he doesn't even know how to sew onto anything, so they just sort of accumulate on his dresser. That's his money. That's his deal. I mean, he sort of has, you know, he has money he's allowed to spend. And I don't think I would be, I don't think it's cool to sort of say to kids, you have this agency and I want you to be independent, but I want you to live exactly the way that I want to live. I don't think that's cool, especially with teenagers. This is a discovery that I think people have to come upon themselves. I mean, when I was a teenager, my room was completely full of clutter and a total shithole and like posters everywhere, stuff everywhere. I would outgrow a pair of shoes but have a sentimental attachment to them, so I would keep them. I would gain or lose weight and keep all my clothes. I would have little nubs of eyeliner pens everywhere that were completely used up, but what if I needed it the one time? And that's kind of how I learned to not live that way, was by being a teenager and living that way. And whenever I see, you know, people's houses and their teenagers have all these rules about how they're supposed to keep their space, I understand baseline stuff. Like our baseline rule is like no food can be left in your room because that's how you get ants. You know, no, you know, trash. You have to empty your own trash. You have to bring down your own laundry. But like if I go upstairs and the laundry is on the floor or Teddy's like bought some dumb thing and it's sort of cluttering up his dresser, to me that is, that's kind of the part of the deal about fostering independence and at letting kids have their own space. It's not their own space if you are telling them what they can and can't fill it with. If they're not putting the burden on the rest of the family, if they're not bringing home like a giant thing that has to be in the middle of everyone's sight line, I don't know. I wouldn't try to impose those, what I see as very adult minimalist values, especially on a developing teenager, because that is the time where you sort of figure out who you are, whether you're neat, whether you're sloppy, whether you need more organization, whether you have spending issues, whether you need help managing money. And that's how you find it out, is by buying crap and crap that your parent doesn't, your mom or dad don't understand why you're buying. So I don't know. I just don't worry too much about the stuff. And I wouldn't try to impose those values too harshly on kids at that age.
Yeah, this is a thing that has been a consistent surprise for me as a parent, is the extent to which children have a profound desire to acquire and hoard objects, right? Like for me as an adult, like I have enough objects. Ideally, I would have fewer objects. Like if somebody, you know, offers me an object, I probably don't want that object. If you're a kid, part of the powerlessness of being a kid is not owning anything. And then, like, when you get to be two or three and you, like, start getting presents and you realize, I can own some things. Like, this garbage messed up Barbie doll is my garbage messed up Barbie doll. And,
exactly.
And it's not anybody else's. It's mine. And don't you fucking dare try to take that away from me. And then now it's like, given the ease with which kids can now acquire little pieces of crap, of like plastic trash with video game characters on them, now my kids each have hundreds and hundreds of little tiny pieces of garbage. And if you like secretly take one of the pieces of garbage that they haven't seen in 6 months and throw it away, they will never mention it again. But if you try to take it away from them while they're looking at it, then it becomes like, this is their most priceless treasure, is this particular little Pokemon keychain. And like, woe betide anybody who tries to take that away from them. I think in the situation with the free box, I think there's a couple things you can do. The first one is you can like say, well, we have to leave some things for other people, but you can take one thing every time or whatever. You can't clean the whole thing out. And then, like as I suggested, you can, when she's not looking, you can sort of spirit some of the stuff away to keep it to a manageable overall total quantity. But yeah, I agree that like to some extent, these are her treasures. She's acquiring treasures and you kind of have to let her do that for a while. Now, in an ideal parenting circumstance, you might also pair that acquisition with like learning to manage your things. You have to put them away properly and you have to keep them relatively orderly. And like you can teach lessons about responsibility and keeping organized and stuff like that. I would be lying if I said that I were really putting a ton of energy into that aspect of parenthood rather than the aspect of like just stick them in a box with a lid so I don't have to look at them all the time, which is what we tend to do.
Yeah, I think there's actually a really simple solution to this problem of the free box, which is every time they take one thing out of the box, they have to put something else in. They have to exchange. They can bring new things home, but they have to then get rid of personal things that they, because there's only so much room and so much space. And that's a concept that I think most kids can understand. And that's the way we have done things historically in our house with the acquisition of free stuff. This doesn't apply to every time you get a present or every time you come from the store, although there is something to be said for the idea of every time you get a Christmas present or a birthday present or some good fortune because of your economic status befalls you as a child, that you should then be required to go and donate something that you own to a charity or a Goodwill or what have you. There is something to be said to that. But I think that for us, the one in, one out rule as a general guideline has been super helpful. I agree with Gabe. I agree with both of you guys, but definitely like I really did remember that feeling of acquisition and ownership and collection is a big part of what children enjoy and feel power from. And that's awesome. However, in many living situations, there are just limits on that. I mean, there just are. It's like you can't keep grabbing stuff. And so I think that because this is a free box, because this is a box where people are putting things in, then it's good to say you can bring home as many things as you want. Every one thing you bring home, you should put something in the box. And I think at that point, then your kid will start to be like, do I really want this dish rack? Or am I just taking it because it's free and it doesn't matter if I take it? The feeling that it actually matters if I take it, that it matters if I acquire it, and it matters to some extent if I bring it home, I think is a good way to help kids learn the sort of lesson of like economy, basically, and decision making. That's what I would do in this case. I think for going forward, our experience has been kind of what Gabe says, that when you throw, you do cleanings, and a lot of those cleanings, we haven't been like, okay, let's sit down and let me ask you about every object that you have and if you want to keep it or not. Because it's right. They do want to keep things. And it's the moment they look at them, they have to keep them. So I would say that over the years, we've done some combination of the two. Now it's a lot easier because they recognize that you're just going to get rid of things. And maybe they recognize that because when they were younger, we did do this a lot. We would do a lot of, like, I would say every other like major cleaning would involve just like, sneaking into the room with the trash bag and just grabbing stuff that we know they haven't touched or seen in 6 months and have outgrown. And then sometimes we would do it with them. We'd be like, okay, we're going to do a big cleaning of the house. You have to, you know, we're going to sit down and let's go through things. And we'd say, do you want this? No. Do you want this? Do you want this? We found that our kids were relatively good at saying, no, I don't need that anymore. It's done. Especially when we told them that we were donating the stuff. That was a big part of it. It wasn't that we were throwing it in a landfill and it was either them or the trash, but the idea that they were giving it to another kid seemed to help with that.
Yeah.
So those are probably the two things I would recommend is like a one in, one out rule for the box. And then in the future, when you get rid of things, tie it to charity, tie it to connect them with the idea that they're not just getting rid of it, they're giving it to another kid.
Hmm. That's a really good idea. I mean, the one thing that's like kind of weird and ironic about kids and their stuff is that sometimes my kids will want to get rid of stuff that like I want them to not get rid of.
Yes. Yes.
You know, like I'm not just talking about like clothes they haven't worn yet that they got for Christmas or whatever. I'm talking about like a stuffed animal that they loved when they were a little kid. And it's more meaningful to me. And at this point, they're just like, whatever, just throw it in the bin. And I'm like, no. So sometimes we have that little conflict too. So we definitely have sort of agreements. You know, they each have these little Eve sort of storage. They're both of their rooms on the second floor. And we have like a sloping roof and there's little Eve closets. And in each of those Eve closets is like the shit that they can't bear to part with that, you know, I would love to. And then the shit of theirs that they can't wait to get rid of that I'm making them keep. So maybe my attitude about this is just a little bit about me, too, because, you know, my husband and I have this ongoing conflict about coffee mugs, just like having too many of them.
Mm. And never have
he has
mugs.
A rule. Yeah, he has a rule with me that when we get a new coffee mug, we have to get rid of a coffee mug. And I'm like, but our kids like made some of the coffee mugs we have, so I'm not getting rid of any of those, right?
You got to get rid of some of those. The early ones are probably just garbage coffee mugs. Terrible, right?
Well,
Nah.
You're supposed to have 7,000 coffee mugs that none of them match. That is the only way to live.
I actually completely, I'm so glad to hear I'm not alone in this. So, you know, I think that, but it just goes to show, like, that's what's important to me. And I don't think it would be fair. I mean, yes, of course, there's the whole thing about accumulation and materialism. And I think the whole stuff, I think the message about charity is the right message. And the give one, take one is a great message. But in terms of, like, don't buy stuff, then what are you giving your kids? Like, why are you encouraging them to work and have money? I mean, that is part of the deal. It's part of the agency of growing up and adulthood. And I don't think it's fair to put like your exact values around materialism and objects on kids. I think there's an unfairness about it. And maybe it's because part of me still feels like Gabe, like it still makes me feel good on some level just to be able to go and buy something and be like, this is my shit, you know? So I don't know. Maybe it's just me.
Well, regardless of what it is, I do want to give the letter writer a shout out for the phrase minimalist hellscape, which I would now be using to describe every coffee shop and salad place between here and San Francisco for the next 10 years.
And those stupid tiny houses, those people who like want to move to these stupid tiny houses with their like four kids and they're like, we don't need any stuff. We're just going to live in 200 square feet. I'm like, that is not fair. That is insane. And your kids should not be forced to live in a minimalist hellscape.
I think on that we can all agree. All right. Thanks, Sally, for the letter.
Hey, Care and Feeding listeners, it's me, Lucy Lopez. What do ASMR, AI chatbots, and diet culture all have in common? They are all topics explored on Embodied, the Ambie Award-winning weekly podcast from WUNC, North Carolina Public Radio. Each week, acclaimed reporter Anita Rao holds up her journalistic lens to all kinds of things that are sometimes hard to talk about, like sex, health, and relationships. Embodied dives into what some considered taboo to answer important questions about our bodies and our society. Nothing's off limits. Hear from expert guests, including doctors, historians, and psychologists, as they break down everything from the dynamics of egg donation, how couples combat mental health struggles like schizophrenia and OCD, and the profits and pitfalls of the self-care industry. If you need a place to start, I highly recommend checking out their recent episode where Anita interviewed two couples who continued to choose each other after one partner came out as trans. So go ahead, follow Embodied and get new episodes every Friday wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's now the time on our podcast when we recommend things to you that we have found helpful in our parenting journey, and we hope that you will also find helpful in your own. Carvel, do you have a recommendation for us?
Yes, I am recommending the book Mama, Do You Love Me, which is an old book that I haven't seen for years. I'm sure it got tossed in one of the purgings, but I recently came across it at someone else's house. It's a book by Barbara M. Juice, J-O-O-S-S-E, and it's illustrated by Barbara Lavallee, who is an artist that Joe and I have always liked. We weirdly went on our honeymoon to Alaska, of all places, which actually was amazing, but people think it's really weird, but that's the kind of people we were. So we did this whole thing through Alaska for a honeymoon, and while we were there, we encountered the art of this woman, Barbara Lavallee, who does these, I'm not really up on what the technique is, but these really interesting and intricate paintings of Alaskan people. And she illustrated this book. The book, Mama, Do You Love Me, is a book for, you know, any kid from the age of 18 months to 4 or 5 years. And it's just a kid asking his mother, Mother, will you love me if I did this? And the mother says, well, yes, that would make me sad, but I would still love you. And the kid goes, well, would you love me if I did this? And the mother says, well, yes, then I'd be angry, but I'd still love you. And it just goes through like that. Each page, beautiful illustrations. Mama, Do You Love Me? A classic from our household.
How far does the kid go with these questions? Like, does he ask about, like, what if I committed a murder?
No, that's in the sequel. Mother, would you love me if I committed a murder? No, I don't remember how far, because I actually didn't reread it this time. I just saw the title and was like, oh, I remember that book. But it's a lot of stuff like, if I ran away, if I... It's a little bit like... What's the other one? What's the bunny one where, like, yeah, the mother's like, I will find you anywhere and you will never escape me. And
Runaway Bunny. Terrifying book. Terrifying.
It's a little... It's like the Runaway Bunny, but less terrifying.
Oh, that sounds good.
It's like the loving antecedent to the Runaway Bunny without the stalky horror.
Nice. I have a recommendation, and some people are going to accuse me of cheating, but technically I'm not cheating, and also in as much as I am cheating, I'm cheating in for deliberate effect and with a deliberate intention in mind. So, on a previous episode of this podcast, I recommended the book The Saturdays by Elizabeth Enright. I was reading it to Eliza at bedtime. We have now moved on to the sequel, The Four-Story Mistake, also by Elizabeth Enright, about the four Melendi children. It's so good! Holy cow! I read this when I was a kid, and I had a sort of dim memory of liking it, but I didn't really remember why. But we are just so into it, and every night now I read to her for like half an hour because these are long chapters, and they're rich with incident and character and story, and they're beautifully written, and I get really into it, and she also gets really into it, and it teaches her some words that she doesn't know, and sometimes I stop and ask her. But if I don't stop, then she just listens, and she absorbs the whole thing. And it just like a beautiful, beautiful book about a family of four kids growing up in the middle of the 20th century and figuring out ways to entertain themselves, putting on plays and building tree houses and all this sort of old-fashioned stuff. But it's not whitewashed or sanitized. It feels incredibly like genuine to the anxieties and fears and triumphs of childhood. And she relates to it in what I think is a profound way. And near the beginning of the first one, she asked me, like, does this have any magic parts in it? Because most of the books that she reads now are books about, like, you know, going to a mystical realm or, like, fighting a dragon or whatever. And I said, no, it doesn't have any magical parts. It's just about some regular kids. And she said, oh, okay. She seemed a little disappointed. And and now I feel like this has opened her eyes to the possibilities of literature that doesn't have any magical or fantastic elements. And these are great, great books. So today I'm recommending The Four-Story Mistake, the second volume in the Melendi Quartet by Elizabeth Enright.
It's good. Really good. I actually kind of want to check that out now. You described it so beautifully.
Well, yeah, I do think adults who like to read young adult fiction, I think would probably enjoy this a lot.
I do like to read young adult fiction, and I'm going to recommend an unpopular piece of young adult fiction, at least unpopular now, and I don't care, because it was a revelation for my son and his first foray as a teenager into reading a book that felt adult and felt fun. Right now, there is a lot of growing animus toward Ready Player One, I suspect, because the movie adaptation by Steven Spielberg is on its way out, and all the promotional material for it are coming out. And yes, it is packed with very cheesy nostalgia that, you know, makes everybody believe that the only thing we have in our culture is all about white guy nostalgia. I'm just going to put in a plug for Ready Player One as a book for like a 12 or 13 13-year-old boy to read. It is important to remember that when Teddy read Ready Player One as a 12 or 13-year-old boy, like, he does not actually know any of the 80s references that are peppered throughout the book. What he really got out of it and loved about it was sort of this, like, larger soaring story, this sort of Black Mirror-esque story about a technology scape that had taken over the world and the adventures that happened inside of it, which, if you step back a few steps, is not a whole lot different than the type of stories we loved when we were kids, like Madeline L'Engle's Wrinkle in Time, where there was a technology aspect of it that hurtled kids into a parallel world where they had to have adventures and adversity. So I'm putting a big, fat, proud plug in for Ready Player One by Ernest Cline. Teddy read it when he was 12, 13. He still says it's one of his favorite books. I read it at the same time he was reading it. We talked about it a whole lot at dinner. Yes, there's a lot of stuff about it that's, like, you know, turning people off right now. But there's merit in a book like this, especially when you have a kid who traditionally doesn't love to read. It's one of those books that I think does a really great job sucking kids like that in, especially kids that have interests in computers and video games and technology and, you know, music and pop culture. It's fun. And sometimes things that are fun are worth it, even if everyone tells you that you're supposed to hate it. So that's my recommendation. Ready Player One, the book by Ernest Cline.
And that is our show for today. If you have a question that you want us to address on a future episode, you can call us at 424-255-7833. If you want to join the discussion about this episode, last week's episode, the show in general, our parenting styles, our personalities, you can do that in the Slate Parenting Facebook group. Go to Facebook and search for Slate Parenting. Our episode today was produced by Benjamin Frisch with some help from Daniel Schrader. For Carvel Wallace and Rebecca Lavoie, I'm Gabriel Roth. We will see you next week.